The American POTUS Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit show supported by listener patriots just like you. To help us keep the program going, please join others around the nation by considering a tax-deductible donation. You can make your contribution and see what exciting plans we have for new podcasts and other outreach programs at AmericanPOTUS.org. Thank you for your support, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Coming up on American POTUS, an overdue visit to the Library of Congress. It sits in the shadow of the U.S. Capitol itself, a prominent location that serves a distinct purpose, to remind us of the importance our forefathers put on having an educated nation. Walk in the doors and it's clear this library is unlike any other. A vast collection of over 170 million books, videos, maps, audio files, and anything else that might tell the story of our nation for future generations. We're getting a rare look at the Library of Congress and all the presidential perspective it offers. It's on this special episode of American POTUS. I'm Scott Brun. With the help of presidential scholar Alan Lowe, we're opening the book on the men who have held our nation's highest office. By sharing their challenges, their stories, and their personalities, we hope to add some clarity and perspective for today's heated political conversations. This is one of eight episodes in our special American POTUS Road Trip series, a chance for us to share some of Washington, D.C.'s most significant presidential sites. We hope you enjoy these revealing conversations and they inspire you and your family to visit these important places for yourself. We're here in the gorgeous and incredibly historic Library of Congress with two outstanding guests to help us understand the important role the library has in making presidential history accessible. Michelle Kroll is the Civil War and Reconstruction Specialist in the Manuscript Division here at the Library of Congress. She is the author of several articles and books relating to the Civil War, as well as Quantico, Virginia, and the World War II Memorial in D.C. Meg McAleer is a historical specialist in the Manuscript Division of the Library of Congress, where she oversees acquisition and outreach of the division's modern diplomatic and military collection, as well as the presidential papers of William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, and Calvin Coolidge. Michelle and Meg, thank you both for your hospitality. We've been looking forward to this conversation.
Well, we're always happy to talk about our presidential collections.
We're looking forward to this as well.
Michelle and Meg, thank you so much. Really excited about talking with you today. Let's start with some basics about the Library of Congress. So when was the Library of Congress formed and what's its mission?
Well, so the Library of Congress was formed in 1800 when John Adams approved an act of Congress that moved the government from Philadelphia to the new District of Columbia. And $5,000 was appropriated for the purchase of books to be housed at the Capitol. So that's the origin of the Library of Congress. And our current mission is, very broadly speaking, to engage, inspire, and inform Congress and the American people with a universal and enduring source of knowledge and creativity. And that also harkens back to something that Thomas Jefferson wrote about his idea of, about a Library of Congress, particularly when he was thinking of selling his books to the library after the War of 1812 and the fire in Washington. He said, "There is, in fact, no subject to which a member of Congress may not have occasion to refer." So that's something that also guides us, because Congress does have to engage in a wide variety of subjects, and we're here to help provide the knowledge and background and resources they need.
I think it's impressive. From the very beginning, the founders knew that was vitally important. I assume $5,000 was a pretty big sum back then.
It was more sizable then than it is today. That's for sure.
So how many facilities now comprise the Library of Congress?
Oh, we have a very large footprint on the east side of the Capitol. So we have three buildings on Capitol Hill. There is the absolutely gorgeous Thomas Jefferson Building, which is designed in the Beaux-Arts style. Many people think it's the prettiest building in Washington. I happen to be one of them. It was completed in 1897 when the library had outgrown its quarters in the Capitol itself. Then right behind the Jefferson Building is the John Adams Building, which is, again, just architecturally so interesting, but in the Art Deco style. And it was opened in 1939. Then Michelle and I work in the newer James Madison Building, which was opened in the 1970s. And architecturally, people have suggested that it's the box that the Kennedy Center came in. And I'm not going to dispute that. But we also have some facilities away from Capitol Hill, including the National Audiovisual Conservation Center, which is in Culpeper, Virginia. It is so cool. First of all, it is a state-of-the-art film and sound recording conservation center. Just doing incredible work. But the really neat thing is that it's located in a building that was built in the 1960s in the middle of the Cold War for the Federal Reserve as a high security storage facility.
Oh, wow.
And repurposed as a film and sound conservation center. It's really, really cool. It's just beautiful.
I loved coming in here. You gave me a warning or a heads up to look up when I came in the James Madison building with the falling books. That's really a cool feature to this building.
Oh, it really is. Well, and also, in addition to the facilities that Meg mentioned, we have offsite storage facilities in Fort Meade, Maryland, to house our expanding collections, plus overseas offices that are facilitating the international aspect of our collections. And what people may also not know is that in addition to the books and those kind of library services that people might anticipate, we're also the home of the Congressional Research Service that provides research and analysis for Congress. We're the home of the U.S. Copyright Office to administer copyright. And we also have the National Library Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. So we really do have a very expansive reach in terms of who we serve and what resources we have available.
Huge operation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And a major portion of it is what you can think of as the National Library. Mm-hmm. So we have 25 million books. And also, periodicals. And I'd say maybe like half of them are actually in languages other than English. So in addition, we have special area reading rooms for different parts of the world, a European reading room, Asian, African and Middle Eastern, Hispanic reading rooms. The Jefferson Building also has our rare book division, which has our oldest, rarest books. But the library also collects a lot more than books. And so we have entire reading rooms devoted to different formats. We have an entire reading room just for maps, another one for prints and photographs, one for film, another one for sound recordings, for music. And then we also have the manuscript division, which is where Michelle and I work.
I may never leave here, frankly.
You may not. You may not.
Amazing place. I think my wife will tell you I come close to your book numbers. I do at my house. I love books. So how many people use the Library of Congress every year?
There's various statistics about how things are being used, and plus there's on-site use versus online use.
Yeah.
In fiscal year 2020, we know that we responded to over 800,000 reference requests from Congress, the public, and other federal agencies. So, we have a very broad reach outside of just the people who are coming to our facilities or going on the website, too.
And the manuscript division actually is, I think, the most heavily used of our special collection reading rooms. As you probably know, our collecting focus is U.S. history. Covering 400 plus years of it. And we've got about 12,000 collections in the manuscript division, which can range from one item, like let's say a letter or a diary, up to our largest collection, which are the records of the NAACP at 3 million items. And all told, we have about 71 million items in the manuscript division. And in the before times, our reading room would have between 8,000 and 10,000 users a year. So very, very heavily used. And then also an increasing presence online with digitized collections.
So I'm so impressed with your digital world you've created here, and I know we'll talk more about that today. Now, Michelle, I understand you oversee the collections held here pertaining to presents from James K. Polk, my personal favorite, to Theodore Roosevelt. So before we get to the specifics, though, can you tell me, how can we access those records?
Well, happily, the 23 presidential collections in the Manuscript Division of the Library of Congress are now very easily available online at loc.gov. And the collection material is accessible through their respective online presentations that you'll see when you go into digital collections, and through hyperlinks in collections finding aids. And the finding aids are essentially roadmaps or guides to the collections. And the online presentations also offer images of sample content. So if you're not familiar with some of the collections, you can go and look at the featured content to get a sampling of what's there. We have lists of related resources if you're interested in further study, timelines of the individuals, and other useful content for the researchers. So we do have to mention that the pandemic did interrupt a little bit of our scanning operations, so there are still some things that are yet to come. But particularly for the microfilm editions that we digitized, that's available for you 24/7, totally free of charge. So, but one thing that to remember about researching presidents, so if you're researching James K. Polk, which it sounds
I
like...
I know everything about him.
I was going to say, it sounds like you probably have already done this, or other historical figures, is you might start with their set of papers, but you're also going to want to look at the collections of other people, because if they wrote a letter to someone else and didn't keep a copy, then that letter is in someone else's collections. So that's another strength here at the Library of Congress, that we have so many of the political associates and friends and family members of those presidents. So, but you know, again, remember to go farther afield than just the presidential papers themselves.
Sure. Now, do you also have other artifacts, photographs, those types of things in those collections, or are they all paper? What are the collections comprised of?
All sorts of things can end up in a presidential collection. So correspondence dominates. That and it's typically letters from other people to the presidents. So constituents, members of the public, other political figures, they write to the presidents, and that's what comes into it. Or families. It can be from a whole huge variety of people and a variety of topics, too. But the collections might also include their speeches and writings, diaries, financial records, scrapbooks, printed material, photographs, and an occasional artifact. That's not we don't usually collect artifacts specifically, but they do come in with the collections sometimes too. So as the special collections divisions at the library tend to collect and by format of material, it may make sense for some of the photographs to be transferred to the prints and photographs division, or the maps to be transferred to geography and maps, because they can be better housed and interpreted and used there. But we try to keep that intellectual connection of the James K. Polk papers or the William Howard Taft papers as part of the catalog records, so that you're able to see, this was part of it initially. With artifacts, a great example of that is the Abraham Lincoln papers are here in the manuscript division, but the contents of Abraham Lincoln's pockets from the night of his assassination are held in the Rare Book and Special Collections division, because that's more of their special format.
I will encourage our listeners to go to lsc.gov. When I found those digital collections, you had to tear me away from the computer. It's so much fun going through, and you learn a lot. This really an amazing resource for people. So I really applaud the Library of Congress for doing that. Let's jump back into James K. Polk. You have in that collection his huge 25-volume diary. What can you tell us about that diary?
Well, what we can tell you about the diary is that he kept a record of events. It's only for his presidential years, which was only one term. It kept a record of events from August of 1845 to June of 1849. And they're written in 25 volumes that are about 100 to 250 pages each. So altogether, that's just under about 4,000 pages of diary. So essentially maybe 1,000 pages a year of diary. And he specifies the year after he starts keeping the diary, why he did it. So a year into it, he says, "It occurred to me that I'd had a particularly important conversation with Secretary of State James Buchanan about the Oregon question, and I wanted to make sure that I kept a record of that, and that seemed like a really good idea. So the next day I went out and bought a volume and started writing." And so he kept that up throughout the years of his presidency, with a few gaps, but not that many.
What a resource that is. Well, do you have other presidents that kept diaries like that?
We do have other presidents, not to the same degree as Polk did. And I can give you some examples of some of the things that he included in his diary if people want to get a sense of that.
Please, let's do
so,
it.
Yeah, actually, let's talk about Polk's diary, and then we can talk about some
of the
other presidential diaries.
Are you kidding me? Let's do the whole episode.
I was going to say, I didn't think I was going to have to twist your arm too much to talk about that. So what people will find, if unlike you, they haven't jumped into the James K. Polk diaries yet, is it's a day-to-day record of his administration from an official standpoint, but it's also a glimpse into Polk's personality, his workaholic tendencies, and his opinions about the people in the world around him. So you get a sense of what he does every day and sometimes what he thinks about things. So on the workaholic tendencies, that's something that comes through very, very clearly in that. And in 1848, he actually says, "No president who performs his duty faithfully and conscientiously can have any leisure. If he entrusts the details and smaller matters to subordinate, constant errors will occur. I prefer to supervise the whole operation of government myself rather than entrust the public business to subordinates, and this makes my duties very great."
Wow.
Even in a time of more limited government and not the scale that we're on now. So it's probably not a big surprise that he doesn't do a lot of social events. I have to admit, in 1846, he's a little bit of a killjoy when Alexander the juggler comes to perform. And his comment is, "I thought the time unprofitably spent." Once in a while, he'll go to dinner with friends with his wife. But you really do see him constantly at work and not really having a chance to enjoy Washington or, you know, enjoy much of a leisure time other than maybe going to church with his wife. So sadly, he wrote on March 4th, 1849, which at that point was election day, but before it became January 20th in the 1930s, that how he relieved he was to be free from all his public cares. He was only going to be a one-term president. He was happily turning it over to someone else. And you get a sense in his diary, okay, I'm free of this. This is wonderful. And then, of course, he died a couple of months later.
Right.
So very, very short retirement. But to answer your question about other diaries and how commonplace they were, for the presidents that the collections that I oversee, they're not particularly common. And whether that's attributable to the men themselves or that the diaries didn't survive, that's a possibility. So in my collections, we have 7 pocket diaries that Theodore Roosevelt kept as a young man, so not during his presidential years, but those are hugely, hugely popular and interesting. So for me, the closest in terms to the Polk diaries are actually James A. Garfield's diaries. And he didn't quite match Polk's output of 25 volumes, but we have 21 diaries of Garfield's that run from 1848 to basically the last day that he was able to write a diary, which would be July 1st, 1881. And in the second volume of his diary, he refers to it as his journal of daily events and private cogitations, or his confidential friend to whom he entrusts the secret thoughts of his heart, which is a very nice way of explaining how he's interacting with this volume. Now, unfortunately, it's not a complete event or a record of his life. Many of the Civil War years are not encompassed, whether he wrote diaries that didn't exist or he was busy doing other things. And it's very unfortunate because those are important years where quite a lot of things are happening in his life, and we would love to know what he would have entrusted to his secret heart, the secret thoughts of his heart during that period. But other presidents, George Washington, John Adams, Rutherford B. Hayes, they kept diaries as well. The Washington diaries are part of the Washington papers here at the Library of Congress, but the Adams and Hayes are at other repositories.
No real better way, I think, to get a kind of peek inside their inner thoughts, just really terrific resources. Now, another president about whom I want to learn more is Zachary Taylor. And I know many of his papers were destroyed or scattered during the Civil War. How did the Library of Congress gather the Taylor materials that you do have? And how do you think, despite their relatively small size compared to your other collections, how can they contribute to better understanding Mr. Taylor?
Well, our Zachary Taylor papers contain about 650 items, which by our standards is a very small presidential collection. And they were acquired from a variety of sources between 1904 and 2014. So they primarily from descendants of the Taylor family or members of the Taylor family, but it's a collection that has been cobbled together or put together from a variety of different sources. But the thing to remember is that even if a collection is only a single item, that can provide a puzzle piece to seeing something in more of its totality. So even though it's a smaller collection, there are documents there that give you a little bit of a sense of either Taylor, his life, or the life of his family as well, because they're particularly represented. So, for example, I was just glancing at them yesterday, and the family papers contain documentations about the Taylor estate following the president's death in 1850. And the Taylors were enslavers, and in this document about how his estate would be parceled out among the family, the names, ages, and monetary values of over 100 enslaved people were listed on this inventory. And not only does this document detail Taylor's financial status at the time of his death and how that was distributed among his heirs, but it also records to which heir those enslaved people were then assigned or given, for lack of a better word. And so for the descendants of these enslaved persons, that record may be of great value in tracing their family or understanding their own family history, even though the collection may be focused on Zachary Taylor and his family as well. So there's a lot of things that you can use in our presidential papers that are about either the presidents themselves, but also about the world in which they inhabited and the other people who were part of that world, even longstanding or just on a transactional basis.
So let's turn to Franklin Pierce. I saw that you had obtained copies of his diary from the Mexican War from the Huntington Library, another beautiful, beautiful library I've been to many times, and some of his correspondence from the New Hampshire Historical Society as well. Is the copying of materials, I assume now digitally, part of how you add to your collection? So if you don't have those materials in the Library of Congress, do you actively seek to make copies of other parts of collections to add here? Or how do you approach that?
Well, one thing about the presidential papers and some of our legacy collections is you will see more of those photostatic copies or other copies of materials that were either obtained from other repositories or from private individuals. And that was a practice that was a lot more prevalent in the early to mid 20th century. It's not something, so it has the effect of making that content available at the library in a way it might not have been, particularly when you're talking about people who have materials in private hands. But it's something that we don't really do anymore, partially because when it was photostatic copies and a lot of photocopies, we have storage considerations. And so to be adding photocopies of materials that we don't own the originals of is you know, a space issue. Mm-hmm. It also gets into some kind of legal, yeah, you know, questions, mm-hmm, about what can we do with it? You know, we much prefer having the originals, because if you need to consult an original about something or who has intellectual control over it. Yeah. So what you might find in the Pierce papers is something that we would be very unlikely to do today. But because it's part of the collection, you still have access to those copies.
And I assume today you would, if a researcher comes in and they say, I want to learn more, and you know that, say, the New Hampshire Historical Society has those, you'd say you may also want to check out whatever they have there online as well.
Oh, right? Exactly. Right. And that's one thing that if you're going to our online presentations for the presidential papers, sometimes it can be a little hard to see on that homepage, mm-hmm, but if you see the related links, yes, or the related resources, click on it, because that opens more of a bibliographic look at the presence. And if we know that there are other materials at another repository, we may have a link to a finding aid or something along those lines. So we're trying to help the researchers not only access our materials, but also be able to enhance their ability to do research elsewhere.
A great service, for sure. Now, as the former director of the Abraham Lincoln Library Museum in Springfield, Illinois, I will tell you, your Lincoln collection is awesome.
Yes, it is.
It is really amazing. Now, can you tell us about some of the Lincoln treasures you have and how you obtained such an extensive Lincoln collection?
Oh, sure. Well, probably like you, I could talk about the contents of the Lincoln papers all day. And here again, I will refer people online, because under the Articles and Essays tab on the online Lincoln presentation, we have a list called Frequently Requested Documents. And it really is just a list, but it's also hyperlinks to those things. So if you haven't explored the Lincoln papers and you want the kind of quick journey through, that's a good place to start. So, but in terms of the treasures, the ones that come to mind for me, we have the two earliest known copies of the Gettysburg Address in Lincoln's handwriting. We have multiple versions of his first inaugural address that shows the evolution of the text and how he incorporated other people's suggestions and then made them his own. We have the cut and paste reading copy of the second inaugural address, which I love because it's arranged like a script. So he literally cut and pasted sections from a galley proof into essentially a script that would help with his pacing. You have a sense of where he might have paused for emphasis. So I think that one is really interesting. We have the July 22nd, 1862 draft of the Emancipation Proclamation, which he read to his cabinet, but never issued publicly because the one after the Battle of Antietam in September is a completely different document. So it's part of that evolution. We also have the manuscript copy of the bill he intended to introduce while he was in his single term in Congress to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. That also was not introduced because his support evaporated. A particular favorite of mine, which I'm sure you know this one, is the Blind Memorandum of August 23rd, 1864, in which Lincoln expressed doubt that he would win re-election. Because it's important to go back to a document contemporaneously to say, what did they understand at the time? And in August of 1864, the war was not going well. Lincoln really didn't think he had a strong chance of winning re-election. So he pledged to work with the president, the Democratic president-elect, to save the Union and emancipation before the inauguration in March. And then he folded it up, created a little flap, glued it, took it to a cabinet meeting and said, sign this. And all of his cabinet members signed on the flap and they had no idea what they were signing. So ultimately Lincoln won re-election. That's a longer story how that came about. And then they were able to open it later on and see what they had signed. Also the July 14th, 1863 letter that he penned to General Meade, while he was in distress that Meade had not as vigorously pursued Lee afterwards. So he says, your golden opportunity is gone and I am distressed immeasurably because of it. And again, that one didn't get sent. So he put it in an envelope, which we still have, that said to General Meade, never sent, never signed or sent. And I always love to say, this is the email that you write, but never send. You know, that's, you get it out on paper and you're, you move on with your day. So the list of treasures, you know, goes on and on. But then we also have some other gems in the collection, such as this really amazing, also August 1864 letter from Frederick Douglass, commenting on a meeting that they just had at the White House about how to encourage or how to create a plan or a system for encouraging enslaved people in the Confederacy to flee to Union lines while they still had time. So essentially, it's Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln conspiring for an exodus of enslaved people. And then there's also, you know, a fun little letter, a cover letter that someone forwards, jars of tamarind sauce from missionaries in Siam, who this is how they want to express their patriotism. They're halfway around the world, but let's send jars of tamarind sauce. This is the way to, you know, to do this. So you find little nuggets that aren't the Gettysburg Address, but they say something else. And I have a hard time, you know, imagining tamarind sauce and hardtack, but, you know, I'm sure it went well together.
That's our lunch today, right?
Exactly. So onto the question of how we acquired all of these, the core of the Lincoln papers that we have now came through Lincoln's only surviving son, Robert Todd Lincoln, who there's a very long history of the Lincoln papers moving around and being in other hands, but ultimately they came back to Robert Lincoln. And fortunately, the Librarian of Congress, Herbert Putnam, was able to finally persuade him to deposit the collection here in 1919. And then they became a gift in 1923 with follow-up donations from Robert Lincoln's wife and daughter. So the Lincoln family was very generous in giving us these amazing things. Some were transferred from the Nicolay papers, who was Lincoln's secretary, so some Lincoln documents were transferred from that collection. We get them from other sources as well. So as a museum professional, I think you can understand how this was a fantastic day in April 1916, and this is before Robert has even given the core of his papers, when from the surviving children of John Hay and John Nicolay, They gave us two Gettysburg addresses, the second inaugural address, and the blind memorandum all on one day. So, you know, these collections can come from largely from the families, but they can come from a variety of sources.
That's just really an amazing resource. And of all those treasures you mentioned, I too am a huge fan of the second inaugural address. And to think that you have that script essentially there, that's really, we've had Ron White on, the great historian, and one of his wonderful books is Lincoln's Greatest Speech about that second inaugural. I really recommend that to everyone. And this, it's great that you have that here and that you're preserving it for this and future generations. What about Mary Lincoln? Is she represented much in those documents?
She's represented in the Lincoln papers to a lesser extent and not really too much before the presidency. There's letters that Lincoln wrote to her. So, for example, when he was in Exeter, New Hampshire in 1860. And there's a few letters that she wrote to him or, you know, telegrams that she sent. We actually have a check that made out to wife, you know, from back in 1860.
I don't know if that would work now. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you'd need a better endorsement than that. But one that's really wonderful is when Mary Lincoln has gone off to New York in November of 1862, she writes to him and she mentions that Elizabeth Keckley is with her. And Elizabeth Keckley is trying to raise funds and get goods for what are called contrabands, who are, you know, essentially escaped or freed enslaved people, that particularly in Washington, D.C., and mentions, I've given her money from this, you know, I don't think you're going to mind. I've given her money so that she can get things as well. So Mary is talking about what she's doing, but then you get that glimpse also of what Elizabeth Keckley's doing and a little, you know, even just a glimmer there of their relationship as well. But in addition to Mary being represented in the Lincoln papers, we also have a small collection of, you know, of Mary Todd Lincoln papers, and those have been gathered from a variety of sources too. But some are from the post-war period. In fact, most of them are from the post-war period. But we do have two just of the absolutely magnificent letters that she writes in the wake of Willie Lincoln's death. So one from the White House and one from the Soldiers' Home, where she reflects on, she apologizes that she hasn't been able to write, but she could scarcely command herself to write, that she's been so prostrate with grief. And those are just incredibly affecting letters, you know, seeing and knowing the grief that she's gone through. And here again, this is where you also have to think, who did Mary write to and where might those letters be? And she was friends with Mary Jane Wells, who was Secretary of the Navy Gideon Wells's wife. So you'll actually find Mary Lincoln letters in the Gideon Wells papers as Mrs. Lincoln writes to Mrs. Wells during the war and afterwards.
I think I know there are many different opinions on Mary Lincoln. I think she is unfairly attacked at times, but I know that's different scholars believe different things. What about Andrew Johnson? I noticed online when I looked at his collection, the diary of his secretary, Colonel William Moore. I didn't know about William Moore. Who was that, and how does that diary help us better understand President Johnson?
William Moore, as you said, was one of Johnson's private secretaries throughout most of the presidential years and then a little bit beyond. And he kept diaries of shorthand notes of Johnson about Johnson primarily during those White House years. And the shorthand notes were then transcribed. So for those of us who don't know shorthand, we can still access them. So when you go to look at what are called the large diary and the small diary, but when you look at those, first you'll see the shorthand notebooks, and then you'll see the transcriptions. And what's great about these diaries is that because Moore was an intimate in the Johnson White House and was serving very directly with Johnson, Johnson might make comments that, you know, sometimes a little bit more candid, or he would express himself potentially more freely around the secretaries than he might have in public or when other people were around. So in these diaries, you get a sense of some of his reactions, some of the things that are happening in the White House, particularly when he's interacting with cabinet members. So, of course, these are going to be valuable in terms of Johnson's scholarship. And I'm laughing because when you start with, I think it's the small diary, he's making comments about some of his own cabinet members and other political figures. And of Attorney General James Speed, Johnson said he did not consider him of any account. His wife, the president, always insisted was the better man of the two. So, you know, unfortunately for James Speed. So you get some unguarded comments. Yeah. You also get Johnson's take on some situations as well. And then particularly as it gets into the impeachment, there'll be more there. So for not that Johnson was always guarded with what he might say and write to other people, but this gives you more of an intimate or an insider view of the White House during those years.
So important. Johnson is one of the harder presidents to understand. I think that's awesome that you have that resource here to dig a little deeper into those inner thoughts. Ulysses Grant, his reputation is coming up in the world. Certainly, he's being reevaluated in many ways as president. Of course, always his memoirs have been respected. I remember years ago reading through those and just being amazed by them. You have drafts of those memoirs, is that right?
Yes, we do.
What can you tell us about those?
So what I can tell you about the draft memoirs, as well as his letters to his wife, Julia, those two resources I think are my favorite things in the Grant papers, that I always enjoy looking through them and discovering something new. And the story of his writing the memoirs to save his family from penury as he's gone bankrupt and then he's dying of cancer. I mean, it's just an amazing story that, to some degree, I wish even more people knew, because it's a whole nother aspect of his story. And particularly when it essentially has a happy ending, not for Grant, obviously, because, he dies at the end of it. But as you say, the memoirs are so fantastic that from the very beginning they were a critical and a literary and a financial success. So all of that straining and effort actually literally pays off for his family in the end. And although not every page of the completed memoir is represented in a manuscript page in the draft, so much of it actually is there. And what's so interesting about the memoirs is they cover sort of birth and, a little bit into his young life in West Point and the Mexican War. But really the bulk of it is the Civil War. And then that's it. So it doesn't get into his presidency. You don't follow him around the world on that incredibly remarkable trip. So the Civil War essentially saves him again, and he revisits it. What the manuscript does that's complementary to the published version, but also remarkable in its own right, is that you can see the edits and additions. So he's written it out by hand, and you can see where things were added later, or he's gone back and corrected himself or something. So one addition or addition to it is that the page about Cold Harbor. I've always regretted that final assault at Cold Harbor. It wasn't part of the original, as he was writing out that section, because you can see that it's on a different paper stock, and he's written on it where to insert it. And I know Ron Chernow talks about this in his biography of Grant, too. So it can't be that he just forgot, because obviously this is something that's really stuck with him. So he wouldn't have just forgotten to talk about it as he's describing that part of the war. So perhaps he was mulling over it or I just can't not address this. So let me write out my feelings about this and tell them where to insert it in the manuscript. So it's there. And then when you read the published edition, you don't realize that it has been a later addition to it. You can also see notes that his son Fred made, because Fred was helping with some of the research. So sometimes he writes a little bit in the margin, no, this isn't correct, or this is the figure here. What I also find kind of heartbreaking, and you can see this when you're really looking at some of the pages, which you can do online, is that on some pages of the manuscript copy, it's clear that handwritten text was added later, because you see Grant's very, very characteristic handwriting from when he was writing out that page initially. And it's, that strong handwriting that you're used to seeing. And then you may see something that's a lot shakier. And you think that's probably later on when he was either in pain or having a really bad day. And that's also the case with some notes that Grant wrote to his doctor. At the end, he was having a very difficult time speaking at all. So in the Grant papers, we have a few notes that he wrote to his son, Fred. But his doctor, John H. Douglas, kept the notes that Grant wrote to him. And we have that collection. Unfortunately, that's not online. But in one case, Grant told his doctor what he had just been writing in his memoir. And it was his views of other generals and the characters of Lincoln and Stanton, which you can find in chapter 70 of the memoir. And I probably, Dr. Douglas added the date on the bottom of it. So with that note, Grant has, providing the note is correct in terms of the date, you know that on July 2nd, 1885, he wrote that text in chapter 70. And so again, the handwriting is allowing you to get a sense of, is this an early edition? Is it later? What's his whole process? Were there things that he excised that were there initially? It's fun to go through them and see the process. I want to tell one other story about Grant and the memoirs and the papers, because there is some correspondence that also complements the writing of the memoirs and his sort of journey at the end, because once his illness got out to the public, then it was in the newspapers. It was essentially America went on a death watch to see, will he finish these memoirs before he dies? And there are a couple of letters from children in the Grant papers commenting on this. And the one that I absolutely love is from March of 1885, and it's from a schoolgirl named Maria Casa Grande, who attended a multi-ethnic industrial school in New York City. And she tells Grant that she buys a newspaper every day so that she can see how he's doing, and that the other children are following along because the boys are all bootblacks or newspaper boys and have access to that information. So not only do you get this heartbreaking, it's an incredibly sweet letter from this little girl who's so concerned about Grant and his progress, but then you also get a little glimpse into the world of working class children in New York, that the boys are having to work, but this is also providing them access to information as well.
Now, your really terrific website includes a copy of a letter to James Garfield from his future assassin, Charles Guiteau. Can you tell us about that letter, and do we know if Garfield responded to it?
Well, actually, this is the one that you're referring to, is the first in a series of letters that Charles Guiteau wrote to Garfield, and it was written on October 16, 1880, so before Garfield was even elected. And it was written from the Fifth Avenue Hotel in New York City, which was a center of Republican Party activity. And so Guiteau wrote, "General, I would like the Austrian mission and call your attention to it as first comes, first served. I will endeavor to have
That's how it works, right?
Well, in that area, actually, sometimes it does. He says, "I will endeavor to have my formal application supported by some of the leading men of our party." And then he goes on to make all these delusional claims about his anticipated marriage to the daughter of a millionaire, and that the publication of one of his speeches is going to win him Ohio and Indiana. And actually, I have a copy of it right here. And you can kind of see at the top, it says, "No answer." At the top. And the thing that's very apparent in the presidential papers, regardless of whose collection you're getting into, is that once a man is nominated for the presidency, even more once he's elected, even more once he's inaugurated, is just the deluge of mail that they get from people who are asking for patronage, appointments, money, employment, endorsement of products that they have. So series 9 of the Garfield's papers is called the Executive Mansion List, and it's literally just a list of everybody who's been writing to them and where it's being referred to for further action. And it's interesting to scroll through, because what you see are the tons of recommendations and requests for appointments, including a March 8, 1881 letter from John Hay, enclosing a letter from Mark Twain recommending someone as minister for Japan. Wow. So, it's on a kind of high level that somebody might actually be paid attention to. So it's not really surprising that, frankly, a person who's kind of a nobody, who's saying, "I want to be the ambassador to Vienna," that he's not necessarily being answered. But unlike other patronage seekers, he was really determined. And the letters kept coming, and the requests changed from Vienna to Paris, which you also see in the correspondence in the Garfield papers. But what you will see in the correspondence is that after the first couple of letters from Guiteau that are original letters, like the one I was just showing you, then they become printed copies of the text. in a file. And fortunately, Garfield's secretary, Joseph Stanley Brown, helpfully added a note in the Garfield papers in January of 1882 that the originals of the Guiteau letters were taken by the district attorney for evidence at the trial and never returned. So Garfield was something of an archivist at heart in terms of his own papers. And his wife, Lucretia, and his secretary, Joseph Stanley Brown, they really did an excellent job in terms of maintaining the Garfield papers, getting them in order, and doing things like Joseph Stanley Brown indicated, we only have the text of these because the Attorney General never gave the originals back. The Garfield papers, as a result, are an excellent record of Garfield's life and career.
I know, as you said, they received a deluge of mail. Was there ever any indication in the Guiteau letters that they said this guy might be dangerous or anything like that?
I don't remember anything in terms of on letters themselves. What I do know is that once Garfield was inaugurated and it was in Washington, he would show up at the White House because, of course, you didn't have to have an appointment at the White House. There were just open hours. He would show up at the White House and continue to press his claims. And they would say, no, that's the Secretary of State. You have to go to the State Department. And then he would bother James Blaine instead. And he became more of a pest, I think, for them. I don't think they necessarily anticipated that he would be an assassin.
With Arthur, Cleveland, and McKinley, three other interesting presidents in their own way, they weren't great with their papers. Arthur had a lot of his burned. Cleveland, I understand, was pretty careless with his. McKinley didn't commit a lot to paper. So what was the Library of Congress still able to gather to help us understand better those three presidents?
And this is probably a good time to mention, particularly since you just said Arthur burned his papers, that until the mid-20th century, a president's personal papers were theirs to do as they wanted with. So that's why the Adams family is at Massachusetts Historical Society. Some remained with the families. So there weren't presidential libraries the way that we're used to now. So there was a lot more freedom in terms of what presidents did with the personal papers. And that's actually why so many of them ended up at the Library of Congress, because then the families could donate them or we could acquire them from other sources. So the three that you mentioned, Arthur's papers are probably the most frustrating because there is so little in the collection. Currently, it just has 4,400 items as compared to 80,000 in the Garfield papers. So the successor has very little. What's been assembled as part of the Arthur papers have come from a variety of sources, but primarily, or at least some of the best material there, came from Arthur's grandson, who we acquired them from. But even with these limitations, there's still some gems in the collection. And I have to admit, I actually became very fond of Chester Arthur as a result of having to study him some more. So, again, probably like most people with you and Polk, there aren't too many Chester Arthur fangirls, I guess. But there's a couple of affectionate letters he wrote to a close friend when he was a young man, and a love letter that he wrote to his fiancée in the 1850s that reveal the very emotional kind of core of the man who will come out later on. So sort of the emotional depths beyond, below the mutton chop whiskers that we're used to. There's a lot of receipts, which don't sound interesting on the face of it, but they reflect his lavish lifestyle while he was the collector of customs of the Port of New York, which was the most lucrative patronage position that you could have. So the bills from Tiffany's and restaurants and all this, it gives you a sense of his lifestyle. But my absolute favorite are the 22 letters from a New York woman named Julia Sand, who wrote to him between August of 1881, as Garfield is still dying, and September of 1883. And so for some reason, she also fixated on Arthur and had faith that he could be a better man, a better president, a better leader than anybody expected. And so she encouraged him. She criticized him. If he did something that she didn't like, boy, she took him to task. And she kept her faith in him, despite the fact that this was an entirely one-way conversation, that he never wrote her back. He did show up at her house one day.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother story. But the fact that at the end, when other things we have kind of eyewitness or hearsay evidence that the Arthur papers were burned at his direction not long before he died, the fact that Julia's letters were saved and retained, I think says something about their significance to him, that she had faith in him, that he may have tried to take her advice, or they just meant something. And so that was fantastic. In terms of Cleveland and McKinley, McKinley communicated more in person than he did in writing. So much of the papers that we have here, which came through his secretary, George Cortelyou, it was more what people wrote to him. But it still gives you a sense of what was happening politically, what people wanted to communicate with him. There are assassination records in the collection, which are sort of interesting as well. Yeah. So there's a scrapbook containing ticker tape reports of the attending physicians, medical bulletins. So, and there was a lot going on during McKinley's administration because it was the time of war with the Spanish-American War and the Philippine-American War. A lot of debates over monetary policy, a lot about immigration, racial segregation and injustice. So even if McKinley himself is not the author of a lot of these letters, and you don't get a sense of the man, you do get a sense of what was coming through his office, how important his secretaries were in terms of answering a lot of that. So you still get glimpses of what was going on in America and what his administration was confronting as well. And then with Cleveland, you can kind of say something similar with the Cleveland papers too. But Cleveland's own deficiencies in record keeping were slightly ameliorated thanks to his wife or his widow, Frances, who after his death and even after her remarriage, she made it one of her missions to preserve his legacy. So in the Cleveland papers, you will see correspondence from her in the 1920s actively campaigning and lobbying to have Cleveland friends, associates, cabinet members, to have them donate their papers to the Library of Congress or at least provide copies. So she wanted this to be a central repository for Cleveland's legacy and the study of her husband. And to some degree, some people did that his friend William Bissell actually did donate original letters. And because Bissell was an intimate friend, you do get more of a sense of Cleveland and some of the things that he complained about and the fact that he didn't like all that French food that they served him at the White House. He wanted the kraut and lamb chop at some restaurant up in Buffalo or something. But you also get a sense of Cleveland, much like Polk, of that they were workaholics. And so Cleveland says things about, the duty that he's very interested in duty and responsibility, even when he's not taking any pleasure from it. So you still get a sense there. But like so many first ladies, they really concentrated their efforts on preserving their husband's papers, trying to get them in a repository where they could be studied and accessed, and really devoted a lot of their time to trying to preserve their husband's legacies.
Yeah, I'm certainly glad that was the case. So Theodore Roosevelt.
Yes.
We recently talked to Bill Brands about Teddy. I know he doesn't like to be called Teddy. I get in trouble for that.
T.R.
T.R., that's right. That collection has to be one of your gems. Can you tell us in general about how big that collection is and some of the items that might stand out to you?
Well, I will not disagree at all that the T.R. papers are a gem. They contain about 276,000 items. Mm-hmm. And they're focused primarily on TR's presidential and post-presidential years. The earlier materials tended to be at Harvard or other repositories, other than the 7 pocket diaries that Alice Roosevelt Longworth later donated. And TR and his wife Edith specifically chose the Library of Congress to be the repository of his presidential papers. So in 1916, he wrote to Herbert Putnam, and he said, Mrs. Roosevelt and I have been talking over my great mass of papers, and he described them as in immense numbers, copies of my letters and of letters to me while I was president, also letters from sovereigns, et cetera, et cetera. They ought to be in the Congressional Library. And we said, sure. And they started coming. And I think with TR, it's also important to remember that among all the other things that he did, he was also a historian. So he appreciated the availability of source materials and the historical legacy of there too. And he mentioned copies of letters, and for him, the use of letterpress and carbon copies were a way of reproducing retained copies. That mean for the TR papers, you have much more of at least the content of what T.R. wrote to other people, even if the original letter ended up somewhere else. So in that way, the collection can talk to itself. But even with the concentration on the presidency and post-presidential years, the collection offers the full T.R. experience, essentially. His wide range of friends and associates from all walks of life, the myriad of subjects in which he was interested. I mean, he's sort of that, going back to Thomas Jefferson, there is no subject practically in which he's not interested. And it also reveals his admirable and less admirable qualities as well. So you do get a more of a sense of the man and also how he wanted to present himself. I should also note that we are currently engaged in a crowdsourced transcription campaign of the Theodore Roosevelt correspondence. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in helping to try to transcribe TR's correspondence for us, then you go to crowd.loc.gov. And once we have that crowdsourced transcriptions available, TR's correspondence is going to be even more accessible and available than ever before. So we're really excited about that. What stands out to me, and this is just me, other people will be interested in other things. By far the most popular item in the TR papers is his pocket diary from 1884. And because that's the diary in which on February 14th, 1884, both his wife and his mother passed away on the same day in the same house. And in response more to his wife Alice's death, he put a black X on the diary and said, "The light has gone out of my life." And then in subsequent entries, he reflects back on their life together and he says, "For joy or for sorrow, my life has now been lived out." And again, that's the importance of going back to that moment in time. You know, he's 25 years old and he thinks his life is over. He hasn't even started. And then later he goes to the Badlands and, you know, life changes. But so the pocket diaries are wonderful, particularly for early TR. In the 1878 diary, his father passes away. And, you know, hugely important for him. And you see him working through his grief. And then the 1880 diary, he's courting Alice. And so little moments in time. I love the letters that he writes to his really good friends, Cecil Spring Rice. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I always want to call him Spring Roll, which is terrible. I have to think about that.
A franchise, but, right? Here.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so Spring Rice had been his best man at his wedding to Edith. They remained lifelong friends. And T.R. writes really wonderful letters to him about the family, about what's going on. And so you get a sense of the humor and what's involved in TR's life. In the TR papers, there's also some really wonderful letters that he writes to his son Archie when Archie is off at boarding school. And at that point, only Ethel and Quentin are still living in the White House. But there's wonderful descriptions of the antics of Quentin and the White House gang. So those are always great fun,
Shetland
too.
Shetland pony on an elevator or something. I've heard this story. Or
yeah, those are earlier ones. The two that always stand out to me for those Archie letters, which are in Series 16, one is when Quentin and his friends, which includes William Howard Taft's son, Charlie, as part of the White House gang, they're bored on a rainy afternoon, and they start putting spitballs on the paintings. Right. And even TR cannot put up with this.
Right,
you know,
right,
you're bores, you're acting horribly, you should be ashamed of yourself. And another one, Quentin, they come back to the White House. He's long story short, he's on roller skates, he has three snakes in his arms. But just the kind of antics of those are fun to follow along with. There's some correspondence with John Muir about their really important camping trip in 1903. There's also, I enjoy the scrapbooks that are part of Series 15, that they cover through newspaper clippings some of the earlier periods of TR's career. And there's a especially good one when he's the police commissioner, and it's called, I've got a copy of it if you want to see it. It's called "The Combination Was Too Much for the Cop," because TR and Jacob Riis and others would go on these midnight rambles of New York City to see if the police were the beat cops were doing what they were supposed to and kind of get a sense of life. And that's when TR starts becoming known for the pince-nez glasses and the big teeth. And so this poor cop is on Roosevelt Street with the opticians and the dentists and just freaking out because he thinks that Roosevelt has come around the corner. So, you know, you have a wonderful sense of that. And And one other letter that I'll mention, even though the original is in the Herbert Putnam papers and he was Librarian of Congress, in the letterpress we have the text of it, because in October of 1902, T.R. was recovering from the leg wound that he sustained in the carriage accident in Massachusetts. So he says, I lead this sedentary life. So he contacts the Library of Congress to say, I want these books. What do you have on these subjects? And of course, we deliver, literally. So yeah. T.R. gets the books. A couple of days later, he's sending Herbert Putnam a book report practically. I like this, I don't like this, et cetera, et cetera. But I think you'll understand why I appreciate this as someone who also loves books and reading. He says, it has been such a delight to drop everything useful, everything that referred to my duty, everything, for instance, relating to the coal strike and the tariffs or the trust or my power to send troops into the mining districts or my duty as regards summoning Congress, and to spend an afternoon in reading about the relations between Assyria and Egypt, which could not possibly do me any good and in which I reveled accordingly.
Yes.
I have been reading Thackeray Dickens and Scott myself recently, and I felt as if I simply had to enjoy a few days of history.
I love it. Yes, I know that feeling. That's awesome.
Keep repeating this, I know, but in addition to the TR papers, we have so many other collections of his family, his friends, his political associates. So the Library of Congress really is a fantastic resource for the study of Theodore Roosevelt.
You have a really cool job.
I do indeed.
Those are amazing collections. Thank you, Michelle, for telling us some more about this. I really encourage everyone to go to loc.gov and look at those. And now I'll turn to you, Meg. You oversee the collections of three really interesting presidents, Taft, Wilson, and Coolidge. So let's start with Taft. I understand that collection is immense.
It is immense.
Can you tell us about the size? And what all does it cover? Is it just the presidency or pre and post?
No. In fact, that's why it's so big. It's our largest presidential collection. It's 676,000, give or take a few, items.
Wow.
And I know, which everyone always says, well, of course, it's the biggest,
because
Taft was so big. You know, he was 6 feet tall, north of 300 pounds. But the reason it's so big is exactly what you mentioned, is that it covers his life and his incredible public service, including his presidency, as well as his time as United States Chief Justice. And the only man to have held, of course, both positions.
Yes.
But, you know, I think another reason is so big is Taft committed himself to saving his papers. You know, I think he had kind of a judicial sensibility of the importance of historical records, and he committed himself. Also, the collection also includes many of the Taft family papers. Let me tell you, this is a family of overachievers. I mean, oh, my gosh. His father, Alfonso, was a lawyer, a judge, a politician, a cabinet member, an ambassador, and his papers are included in his son's papers.
I think Taft is an underappreciated president. What does the collection have in it about his complicated relationship with TR?
Oh, my goodness. One of the greatest male friendships gone awry.
Yes,
I mean,
right.
You know, think back to Adams and Jefferson.
Yeah.
I mean, it is full of epic drama. So there's a lot, as you can imagine,
yes.
About the highs and the lows of this relationship. Just to kind of provide a little bit of background, Taft and Roosevelt developed their friendship in 1890 when Taft receives his appointment as U.S. Solicitor General and moves to Washington. And he lives very close to the Roosevelts. And this is a case of the opposites attracting. So, you know, as we know, T.R., his personality was larger than life. He was a man of action, you know, bordering on impulsiveness.
Yes.
Taft, by contrast, was quieter. He was more deliberative. But he was immensely kind and funny and absolutely lovable. And I just want to give a shout out to Michelle. She was the first one to clue me into how lovable Taft is. I really recommend Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Bully Pulpit.
Yes,
and Michelle had been a research assistant for that book. Advancing forward, their correspondence begins once the Tafts leave Washington. And so you have hundreds and hundreds of letters between the two of them. When Roosevelt becomes president unexpectedly, 1901, by 1903, he has a second opportunity to nominate an associate justice to the Supreme Court. By this point, Taft is Governor General of the Philippines, and Roosevelt reaches out to his friend, his good friend Taft, and he says, I really want you for this nomination. And this is incredible. This had been Taft's lifelong dream. Like his entire life mm-hmm. was oriented toward eventually getting on the Supreme Court. But he turns Roosevelt down. Mm-hmm. And because the situation in the Philippines was so critical at that moment, he didn't think he could leave. So it's amazing that he sets aside his own lifelong ambition for the sense of service. And so Roosevelt's not done with him. He tries another tactic and he says, okay, eventually, how about Secretary of War? Come be my Secretary of War and you can still stay involved in the Philippines. Well, that argument wins the day. And Taft comes back to Washington. And he ends up being kind of the Roosevelt administration workhorse. He is Roosevelt's go-to guy on the cabinet. There's a wonderful cartoon that I love. It's 1905. It shows Taft juggling his duties as Secretary of War, but also all of the other responsibilities that Roosevelt has put on his shoulders. So when Roosevelt decides not to run again for president, it's like, who better? He's going to Taft, you know, as his handpicked successor. And, you know, everyone thinks this is a great idea, except for Taft's mother. And and I love this. I mean, the Taft family, incredibly loving, but they speak truth to each other. And his mother writes to him and basically says, don't do this. She says, you know, look, she goes, Roosevelt is a fighter who really cherishes combat. That's not you. And, you know, she says, the malice of politicians will make you miserable. And she is exactly right. So, and I think even Taft's kind of reluctant. I don't know that, I mean, he wants the Supreme Court. I don't know that he really wants the presidency, except his wife, Nellie, does. I mean, Nellie really wants this for him. And so fast forward, you know, he runs, he wins, and is inaugurated on March 4th, 1909. And there's a tradition that the outgoing president would ride back to the White House in the carriage with the newly inaugurated president. Only Roosevelt says to him, actually, see you. I'm going to the train station. You know, good luck with everything. And so Nellie ends up being the first first lady to sit beside her husband going back to the White House. And we have this wonderful picture of her. She looks so happy and so smug. I mean, she looks like the cat that swallowed the canary. I mean, she is, you know, is like, yeah, I did this, you know. But there's a lot of kind of foreboding, you know, around the time of the inauguration. The Roosevelts also break precedent by inviting the Tafts to dinner and to spend the night before the inauguration. And years later, when Taft loses his reelection bid, and his aunt writes to him and says, will you invite the Wilsons to dinner the night before the inauguration? And Taft said, you were at that other dinner. You know how funereal it was.
Yeah.
And so I think there was a lot of kind of foreboding, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. About that relationship. Well, I think a lot of people expected the Taft administration to be kind of, you know, a continuation of the Roosevelt. And I think Roosevelt expected that as well. In fact, there's a great cartoon showing Theodore Roosevelt holding up a Taft mask, right. You know, clearly indicating that Roosevelt's going to be the animating force, you know, behind a Taft presidency. But very quickly, Taft shows his independence from Roosevelt. And, you know, Roosevelt goes on this year-long African safari. Their correspondence, there are a lot of mishaps, breaks down. There are kind of hurt feelings. Roosevelt comes back. Taft doesn't go to greet him. He sends his military aide, Archie Butt, instead. And then Taft goes off to Pennsylvania to give a speech instead. And it's really, at this point, things are beginning to sour between the two of them. And as we know, of course, Roosevelt then decides to challenge his old friend for the Republican nomination. And the collection includes this wonderful letter from Taft to his aunt, in which he says, I'm going to lose. I know I'm going to lose. It's inevitable, but I'm okay with that. The one thing that's going to do me in is the disappointment of my family and my friends, and that will absolutely destroy me. But then he also kind of goes off on Roosevelt, and he said, you know, he expresses the sense that, you know, I've been wronged by Roosevelt, and I don't know if I'm ever going to get over this. And then he says, he talks about Roosevelt's hypocrisy, his insincerity, his selfishness, his monumental ego, and the insanity of his megalomania.
Oh, okay.
So things are bad. And basically, Roosevelt and Taft do an Archie Butt. I mean, they're responsible for what happens to Archie. So Archie was military aide to both Roosevelt and Taft, and he adored both men. So when Taft becomes president, Archie Butt's really happy because he can still bask, you know, in this love, you know, between them. And when there's this rift between Roosevelt and Taft during that election year of 1912, it does Archie in. I mean, he stops eating, he can't sleep, he loses weight, and everyone says, you just need to get away for a while. And so Archie Butt has an opportunity to go to Europe. And even Taft tells him, you know, go, rest up, come back strong, because I'm going to need you. And so Archie does, and he gets on the ship. And you could tell he feels guilty about leaving his comrades. And he telegraphs back, and he says, please book my return trip. I understand the Titanic will be sailing. Please book me passage. And his colleagues do, and Archie Butt is lost on the Titanic. So as you know, Roosevelt and Taft, you know, deliver each other a knockout blow.
Yeah.
And Woodrow Wilson wins the election. But fortunately, you know, about a year before Roosevelt dies, they have an opportunity to reconcile. And this is like so much like Adams and Jefferson. And, you know, Roosevelt's about to undergo an operation that coincidentally Taft had also had undergone before. And so Taft sends him a telegram wishing him well, and that restores their correspondence. But then a year later, Roosevelt dies.
I'm glad that at least they had that opportunity.
Yeah, Taft said that as well. Yeah, he wrote to a member of the Roosevelt family, and he said that how much it mattered to him that he had that opportunity to reconcile.
So the knockout punch they administered to each other in that amazing election of 1912, Wilson was the beneficiary of that, and you have the Woodrow Wilson collection as well, which is likewise gigantic. Can you kind of outline the scope of that collection and some of the neat things you have in
Woodrow Wilson? Yeah, it's not as large as Taft. Nothing's as large as Taft. but it's about 280,000. And again, it's that commitment on the part of Wilson to save his papers. And not so good about saving his personal correspondence, handwritten, unfortunately, but still, you know, it's an amazing chronicle of his life, definitely with an emphasis on the presidency. So much less material from his academic career, his presidency of Princeton, and then his time as governor of New Jersey. But, you know, obviously the war figures prominently in this collection.
Versailles, is that?
Particularly that. The Paris Peace Conference papers are voluminous. And, you know, again, it was where Wilson was placing his attention and the priority. In fact, Wilson broke with tradition by personally going to Europe to participate in the conference. Before that, there was this tradition that sitting presidents did not travel abroad, although Theodore Roosevelt does a couple of times. But basically, they didn't. So Wilson really broke with precedent. And then it was tragic thereafter.
The illness and Edith's role, do you have records related to that controversial part of his life?
That is tragic and fascinating at the same time. So obviously, you know, Wilson comes back and faces opposition in the Senate for the League of Nations, and he decides to take the case to the American people. And in September of 1919, travels 8,000 miles and delivers like 40 major speeches, you know, trying to drum up popular support. And he's convinced the American people are behind him, even though the Senate is not. And it does him in. It breaks him. And he comes back to Washington and suffers a debilitating stroke. And in addition to other health complications. And then it becomes a great guessing game about the extent to which Wilson is still capable of performing the duties of the presidency. His wife, Edith, and his physician, Dr. Grayson, end up controlling access, basically denying everybody access to Wilson. And it's kind of fascinating in the papers to try to parse out the extent to which Wilson is actually being president. There's kind of these like little clues, you know, throughout the papers that you can kind of put together.
Turning last to Calvin Coolidge, the collection there is large as well. Does it cover his long pre-presidential service in Massachusetts, governor and so forth, or is it just presidential? What's in the Coolidge collection?
Well, okay, so this is fitting of Silent Cal.
Yeah.
is that it's much smaller than either the Taft or the Wilson papers, despite the fact it's a modern presidency and it was a two-term president. But we knew that was going to be the case. We knew that we were not going to get his personal papers, that what we would get is something called the executive office file, which I want to make a strong case for. This is an incredibly rich file that documents U.S. in the 1920s during a time of profound social change. So the executive office file, by way of background, was kind of an invention of Taft. Taft reformed how White House filing systems were. And these executive office files pulled together correspondence on given topics. So instead of having the correspondence just range chronologically, it pulls together all the correspondence on the suffrage movement, the subsequent fight for the Equal Rights Amendment, on race, on immigration, on baseball. It's a treasure trove for historians and incredibly rich. It's actually my favorite part of the presidential papers for my three presidents. Just really, really rich.
It sounds like as a former archivist at the Modern Presidential Library, it sounds like the subject file, essentially.
It is absolutely the subject file.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just have a couple quick questions, okay? Is this Library of Congress, similar to libraries in any town USA? Like, do I need a library card to check something out here? How does it work? Or how is it different?
Well, if you want to be a researcher at the Library of Congress, you do need to obtain a reader identification card to enter the reading room and to access library materials on site. The cards are free and can be obtained by completing a registration process. And you can find out more about that online and you do some pre-registration. But digitized materials are available on the Library of Congress website. They're free to use by anyone and without any sort of registration card.
Okay, I have to ask the question. Are there overdue fines?
I love
Come
that.
On.
Who are not? Thank goodness, no. Otherwise, some of us would be in trouble. We're not a lending library the way, let's say, your public library is or your university library. We do loan books to members of Congress to support the work of Congress.
Okay.
And we'll also loan material through interlibrary loan to other libraries.
Okay.
And we also support, exhibits around the world. So many of our rare items will be loaned for exhibits. But it's not a place where you can check out books.
Okay,
that said,
okay.
We have found in some of our collections gentle reminders to some congressmen that they did have books
Uh-oh.
That had exceeded Uh-oh. Their registration their time. So, for example, in June of 1866, the Librarian of Congress sent a form letter to Senator Justin Morrill to remind him that three books had exceeded the time he
Uh-oh.
Was allowed to have them. And I love the fact that one of the books was The Scarlet Letter.
That's great.
He did return them. We do have evidence
okay,
he did return
good.
Them.
Now, as you talked about, this place is absolutely massive. I mean, the buildings, it's huge. Come on, has anybody ever gotten lost?
All the time. Yeah. So a lot, part of our job duties is to direct people, which is absolutely essential. You know, we recommend leaving breadcrumbs. We do have a large facility, you know, three buildings. I remember when I first began using the library, I was a student at Georgetown University. I remember walking into the main reading room and just being stunned by the beauty of it.
Yeah.
But a fellow student said, you know, let me show you the tunnels, you know, connecting the three buildings. We don't have to go outside. We can walk through the tunnels. And these are kind of like, you know, they're exposed pipes. And I'm like, we're going to get arrested. We surely should not be down here. Well, I just want to mention, I actually ended up marrying that student. But with three buildings, we were very large, but always willing to give direction to people.
And I also started my time here at the library as a researcher as well. And it can be very overwhelming at first because of all the tunnels that Meg mentioned and the different reading rooms. But if you're here a little bit, you get to know where everything is. And trust me, it is so worth it.
All right, Meg and Michelle, for each of you, what is your favorite document here at the library?
Yeah.
What's your favorite?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I know it's hard to pick one, right?
Yeah, but this is a slam dunk. I mean, you're going to say, of course, it's your favorite. My favorite document is the rough draft of the Declaration of Independence in Thomas Jefferson's hand. And I just want to point out, and I think this is emblematic of what we preserve here, that final results are important. And the Declaration of Independence is an incredibly important Enlightenment document. But I think the path to the final result is equally important. And it's that path that teaches us. So this draft is in Jefferson's handwriting, a lot of crossed out words. There are annotations by Adams, Franklin, and the other members of the drafting committee. But there's this one point in the draft, it's a sentence that actually doesn't make it into the final version. And it basically places the blame on the king for inciting this rebellion by our fellow citizens. And the amazing thing is that the word citizens is kind of smudged. And historians had long wondered, did Jefferson originally write something else besides citizens? But they were never sure. Well, the library's conservation division has really state-of-the-art imaging equipment. And when they imaged it, they were able to peel back the light spectrum to see that what Jefferson had originally written was subjects.
Oh, interesting.
And you have captured in this document, this physical document, that intellectual leap that no, we are not subjects, we are citizens. And without the preservation of this document, we would have lost that split-second moment in time.
Oh, that's terrific. I found myself a few days ago staring at that document that you're talking about. It was on something that was served to me on social media or something, but I was staring at it, looking at the notations and thinking, okay, you know, they were like, no, this isn't so good. Scratch this out, blah, blah, blah. It is fascinating. Good call. All right, your turn. Your favorite document.
All right, my favorite document is going to sound really silly in comparison with that. But the one that I always come back to over and over again is a letter that Lincoln's secretary, John Nicolay, wrote to his fiancée, Therina, on July 20th, 1862, which is in the Nicolay papers, which is online, so you can go take a look at it. And it's all about bugs. Which again, compared to the rough draft of the Declaration, I'm talking about bugs. But he writes to her because it's summer in Washington. It's hot. The windows are open. There are no screens, and there are gas lights. So every bug in Washington is coming into this office. But the way he describes it is so amazing. And he says, they are all here, the plebeian masses, as well as the great and distinguished members of the oldest and largest patrician families, the Millers, the Roaches, the Whites, the Blacks, yea, even the wary diplomatic foreigners from the mosquito kingdom. Mm-hmm. They hold a high carnival, or a perfect Saturnalia, intoxicated and maddened and blinding by the bright gaslight. They dance and rush and fly about in wild gyrations until they are drawn into the dazzling but fatal heat of the gas flame, when they fall to the floor, burned, maimed, and mangled to the death, to be swept out into the dust and rubbish by the servant in the morning.
Wow.
I mean, the writing of that alone has always appealed to me. But then it does get a little bit more intellectual in that he says, Then I could compare it to what happens during the weekday when all the big bugs come down to the White House and fly around the sun. So he's comparing the big bugs on and Congress and all of the important people who are drawn to the gaslight of Washington of Lincoln during the day. But he says, oh, but then you just think I'd been turning into a bug, and so I'm going to get him out of my hair and go to bed for the night. But I've always liked that, because not everything that we have is earth-shattering, or, you know, we have so many things that are either beautifully written or they give you a little snapshot into something. And I've always loved John Nicolay anyway, and this letter has always appealed to me, both for the message that he gives, but also the beauty and the amazing writing.
That's great. Wonderful.
I just want to point out something from the Rosa Parks papers. And so we acquired Rosa Parks's papers in 2014, and they are available online. So I encourage everyone to check them out. The true gems of that collection are a series of never-before-read writings that she wrote around the time of the Montgomery bus boycott. And they're just incredibly moving, and they reveal her to be an extraordinary writer. Well, there's one series of writings on four yellow pieces of paper, and I see these all over the internet. I mean, they just have flown out of their box. And in it, she talks about her determination to resist racism. But she also talks about the psychological trauma. And she writes, I want to feel the nearness of something secure. It is such a lonely, lost feeling that I'm cut off from life. I am nothing. I belong nowhere and to no one. There's just so much hurt, disappointment, and oppression one can take. The bubble of life grows larger. The line between reason and madness grows thinner. The opening of old wounds are unbearably painful. And no wonder that just, you know, has captivated everyone.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What would you say are the most popular documents here? Like, what do you get the most request for, maybe?
It's also hard to answer the question, because we are always acquiring.
Yeah.
And so if you would ask the question prior to the Rosa Parks papers coming here, Meg would have had a different answer. Mm-hmm. So what's popular can change and add more. I think for the Lincoln papers and for many of our collections, what's popular with the public particularly are some of those iconic documents like the rough draft of the Declaration, the Gettysburg Addresses, you know, the inaugural addresses, things of that nature. For the Theodore Roosevelt papers, that diary entry from 1884, it never fails to move people when they see it either online or, you know, on the occasions we're able to bring it out. But I think for what's popular with people is also documents that, it goes along with what Meg was just saying with Rosa Parks, are, even if now granted, Rosa Parks is a very iconic figure at this point, but documents are items that impart a human story, that I think those are popular with people, because that's also what we're doing, is it's not just documenting the political nature of figures or the government. We're also documenting people. And those are those kind of documents where you see behind the scenes, whether it's Theodore Roosevelt thinking his life is over, or Rosa Parks, you know, trying to deal with living in a segregated world, that really resonates with people. So the iconic documents are always popular, but also the human stories that we're able to tell throughout our collections.
We ask all of our guests this, really, because this is what this podcast is kind of about. We want to give perspective to today's electorate, today's listener. Why do each of you think history is so important for today's public? Like, why do you think people should care about your collections? Like, what does it bring to today's citizen?
I think it gets back to the fact that we're all on a journey. It's extraordinary when you read through our presidential papers and you read letters from ordinary Americans to presidents, and you realize that they're grappling with the same issues that we grapple with. And I mentioned that I think that the journey toward a final result is often more important and illustrative than the final result. And I think that we see that working out in the presidential papers. And you see our nation evolving.
And as Meg was speaking, I was actually writing down almost the same thing. I'm always drawn to to that phrase, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Mm-hmm. And I can't say how many times I've been in a presidential paper or a presidential collection reading something about voting rights or civil rights or financial things, or, you know, there are so many topics that we can appreciate today because we're dealing with them in our own time, mm-hmm. and with our own set of circumstances. But essentially, the nation has been there before. Go back to some of the late 19th century papers that I deal with, and it may be a lot about immigration and racism, you know, racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. And it may be different groups of people for the immigration debate now, but you see a lot of the same kind of rhetoric. Or so to some degree, you can use our presidential papers and the history in terms of what are people capable of, both good and bad. You know, can we learn lessons about how something didn't work in the past and maybe try? It'll be a different set of circumstances, but I think there's always a lot to learn. Or it's also, I always feel as a historian that I can at least take a broader view of things and say, okay, we may have been here before in a different way, but we've faced these issues before and may not have always worked out, but, you know, it is, as Meg said, it's a journey. It's all part of this human continuum, and we can learn from that.
That's what we're all about. You too. Thank you. I could sit here and listen to you guys tell stories all day. This has been fantastic. Hopefully you had a good time on American POTUS.
We did. And getting back to the point, is hard to find your way out of here. We may just keep you.
Okay. Done. I'm here.
Hey, we've got a captive audience, you know. That's a historian's dream.
The presidential collections held at the Library of Congress are phenomenal. And diving into the specifics of some of those collections was a real joy. I encourage all of our listeners to go to loc.gov and take a closer look. There are so many digitized presidential documents that I guarantee you'll look up and realize you've been reading much longer than you thought. The experts at the library not only have collected and preserved these collections, but they work hard to make them accessible for all of us. And these collections, I must mention, are just one of the many, many treasures held at the Library of Congress. We're so fortunate that our founders realized the importance of such an institution, and that subsequent generations have recognized the same. As Scott and I walked into the Madison Building for our interview, I found myself, as not only a fan of recent history, but of ancient history, thinking about the Great Library of Alexandria. So you may know that ancient library existed in Egypt starting in the 200s BC, and it contained much of the wisdom of the ages, written on perhaps as many as 400,000 scrolls of papyrus. It declined over the years and was finally erased from existence somewhere around 275 AD. Although the loss of so much ancient knowledge is a tragedy of immense proportions, let's consider how fortunate we are to have the Library of Congress, which holds much, much more information about our world and our universe than Alexandria ever did. It all goes back, as so much does, to Aristotle. He said, "We all, by nature, desire knowledge. It's built into us." Having institutions like the Library of Congress, the National Science Foundation, the National Archives, the National Academy of Sciences, the Smithsonian, and so forth shows our society's commitment to inquiry, to accessible information, and to knowledge. And only with knowledgeable citizens can any republic, including ours, survive.
Thanks for listening to this special road trip episode of the American POTUS Podcast. We'd like to thank Michelle Kroll and Meg McAleer for joining us to talk about their incredible presidential collections. More information on the Library of Congress can be found on AmericanPOTUS.org. And we would like to thank all of you that have made a tax-deductible financial contribution to support this podcast. In addition to this show, your generosity helps us develop new groundbreaking podcast shows and revolutionary outreach programs, offering clarity and perspective to today's political conversations. If you'd like to contribute, it's easy. Simply visit AmericanPOTUS.org. We appreciate your help. American POTUS is produced by American History Studios. Graphic design by Proudler Design. And original music score by Jonathan Clark Music. Finally, it's our last word from Benjamin Franklin. Quote, "Either write something worth reading or do something worth writing about."